I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, it's an absolutely delightful chat. And I'm chatting to Ben Harding. And I met Ben, I think we talk about this at the beginning anyway, but my band supported Ben when Ben was in the Senseless Things, in the, I guess, the early to mid-90s. And then Ben went on to be in Three Colours Red. We talk about Ben's career in and around discussing some fantastic records on today's episode. And you know you've had a good chat when the podcast is over and you carry on chatting. And I could have carried on chatting to Ben for hours, but I could see my dog at the window needing to go for a walk. So I had to go and take him for his evening walk. But we spoke about catching up and having a pint, and I'm going to try and get Ben back on to do another episode where we discuss gigs and touring and that stuff, which occasionally we do with guests. We get them back on and we switch the questions up, and had such a lovely chat today. I really want to try and get that one recorded as well. Like I say, you're in for a treat with this one. And before that chat gets going, just a few thank yous. I want to thank the team at the Blue Murder Club True Crime Podcast, because they produce this pod. Go check that out. A fantastic episode out recently with Colin Sutton. I can't recommend that one enough. And also I want to thank Scroobius Pip and everyone at the Distraction Pieces Network. And the biggest thanks always go to you lot for listening to this podcast, supporting it. We're well over 500 episodes now, and we're not slowing down. We're having such fun, and all the time I get to press record and have a conversation like the one you're about to hear, I'm not going anywhere with this podcast because it's just so much fun. And what's better than talking to kind people about nice records and interesting lives? And that's what you're going to get today. If it's your first time listening and you've jumped on this because you were fans of The Senseless Things or Three Colours Red, then if you like music from the years that they were putting out records, go check out the back catalogue. As I said, over 500 episodes. You can hear me talking to the likes of Jesus Jones, Carter, The Wonder Stuff, EMF, through to Suede, lots of Blur. They've all been on, and go and explore the back catalogue. There's loads I've missed, but just go and have a good old rummage. And while you're over there, click that little subscribe button, and also we're on Facebook. I say we. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and what's the other one? X, it's called now, isn't it? If you just search Off the Beat and Track podcast, then you'll find it. Give us a little follow on there, a little like, love, share, retweet, whatever it is you do, just to get the word out there, to keep those algorithms going or whatever it is that perpetuates this podcast into other people's ear holes. Other than that, just go old school and nudge your mate and tell them there's this old lispy fella from Essex that gets overexcited talking about music with wonderful people. Other than that, everything you need to know. I won't bore you with the Patreon stuff, but it's there if you'd like to support the podcast. It does cost you $1 a month, but you get loads of other stuff. And you can watch all the episodes over there like this one. But your one-stop shop to find out where you can do all of the stuff that I've just mentioned is our website, and it's off the Beat and Track podcast. It's Beat and not Beaten, off the Beat and Track podcast.com. The links will be in the show notes, so go and explore them. But right now, please enjoy today's wonderful episode of Off the Beaten Track podcast with the delightful Ben Harding.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Ben, how are you today?
I'm all right. Thank you very much. Yes, pretty good.
Wonderful.
I'm currently up in Suffolk seeing my mum.
Oh, lovely. Lovely, lovely. It's do you know what? It's funny enough. I've been looking I'm based in Essex and I've had enough of it. I'm not going to lie. And Suffolk's appealing. I'm actually going down there at the weekend and, having a little look about. I fancy that part of the woods.
Yeah, it's nice. I've known Suffolk all my life. I mean, I'm based in London, but my family, my mum's side of the family is kind of, for the whole of my life, has been in Suffolk. So I'm very familiar with it. Wonderful. If you need some tips, let me know.
I will. I mean, we have met before, many years ago. You won't recall. It was probably, 93, maybe? Mm-hmm. And the Senseless Things played at my venue, the Pink Toothbrush in Rayleigh. And I was the support band. Corner Shop, I believe, might have been tour support.
Not tour support, because I would know them an awful lot better than I do. I think that was probably a one-off.
Oh, okay.
I think the Pink Toothbrush was a one-off. It's one of those gigs that sticks in your head. I've got kind of vague, flashy memories of it.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, if I think Pink Toothbrush, really, I've only ever been there once in my life, and that was that night.
Yeah.
And I've got kind of Saturday Night Beneath the Plastic Palm Trees kind of vibes off it, if you remember that track from back in 1978, 77, 78. And I remember it was dark. It was a really dark venue. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, this is what I'm seeing in my kind of memories. And my memory is notoriously bad.
Okay.
I've got friends who remember the Senseless Things days for me. You know, super fans who are now actual, like, what, some of my closest mates who remember stuff I would never hope of remembering.
Okay.
You
paint the picture.
Because I was having far too much time, far too much of a fun time. And partly because every night was kind of the same, you know?
Yeah, of course.
Hurry up and wait, play the gig, you know? Yeah. But the Pink Toothbrush sticks out. Just because it was the Pink Toothbrush, and you don't forget a name like that or a place like that. And it was, I remember kind of slightly labyrinthine and dark and neon and or UV or some such. I remember black and popping neon colours. Am I right?
You are, yeah. That's not bad, mate. That's not bad. Yeah, there's a little... Back then, there was a neon Pink Toothbrush sign that you would have seen from the stage above the bar. Oh, well remembered,
well,
mate.
Well, there you go. That kind of went into my eyes and never left, you know.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, look, let's kick off your playlist and we'll discuss your career as this pod unfolds.
Sure.
But let's kick things off with the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please, Ben.
Oh, well, I'm going to cheat on all of these, right?
Okay.
Because there's never one definitive answer.
Okay.
I mean, my kind of... The way I come to music is as a fan, really, you know, because that's how I learned to play guitar. It was always by playing along to stuff. So the track I've chosen for greatest intro is Alternative Ulster by Stiff Little Fingers.
Oh, it's a cracker, isn't it?
It is a cracker. It's slightly linked in with those kind of really formative years when you're a musician and you don't yet know you're a musician. When punk really started to take a hold of me, and I mean, I'd seen the Stranglers before that when I was younger. didn't get it, but 6 months later I bought Ratsnor Vegicus. But this song, I was introduced to Stiff Little Fingers by a friend of mine at school, who was from an Irish background, and he introduced me to Stiff Little Fingers and the Wolf Tones and Irish republicanism. So, you know, in one fell swoop, I kind of learned kind of politics from a very visceral level.
Yeah.
And I learned punk rock from a different angle to which I'd known it before. But musically, what this did for me was it was that intro, and it was the harmony, the harmonizing, and the fact that you've got two strings going and you've got one string creating a harmony with the other for a riff. And the first time I heard that, it blew my mind, not least because I thought, I can go home right now and I can play that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I did. I remember distinctly, I left my friend Connor's house and I went home and I picked up I think I had a really crappy kind of Strat copy at the time, bright red and really awful, highest action, but I could still play that.
Yeah.
And it was out of tune. I mean, the intonation was out at the top. I had no clue. But that intro for me was not just an intro to a song. It was an intro to, I can play that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was it. That was me started on the path.
How old would you have been now, Ben?
Oh, Christ. When did Alternative Arts come out? 78. 13.
Right. Oh, so they're important years, aren't they? And to kind of get that. So what you're saying you got from that, when you say you knew you could go and play it, was that already kind of planting the seed of that sort of, I guess that sort of punk ethos of like, well, we can do this.
Like yeah. That. Yeah, absolutely. But that was the first time that there was a practical application to that.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I had, at 13, I had Ratsnor Vegicus. I had possibly a couple of, you know, like X-ray Specs single, maybe another couple of bits and pieces, but it was still early days. I was still pretty young.
Yeah.
And I wasn't that self-confident when I was in my early teens.
Yeah.
You know, so I was, and I didn't have a lot of money, you know, so I didn't, and I wasn't going out and buying records on the regular or anything like that. You know, my new records came at Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, that was the period when I was getting Queen's latest LP.
Yeah.
Like every Christmas from my gran, because she knew, and I knew that Queen had this brilliant habit of releasing their latest LP in early December.
Yeah.
So that basically it'd go to number one over Christmas,
yeah,
and everybody would buy it for their kid, you know. And that was the kind of the height of what Queen were doing, you know, because it was Day at the Races, Night at the Opera, blah blah blah. So where was I going with that? So I wasn't going out and buying records a lot, but the ones I did have, most of them I couldn't play along to.
Yeah,
you know. Obviously, I'm not Brian May, but I could be Jake Burns.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. So, I mean, I'm really curious around this time period of like that kind of sort of tail end of the 70s as it sort of turned into the 80s. And I was talking to someone the other day about it, just watching some of the sort of retrospective Top of the Pops that they put on a Friday. And when you watch, you see the sort of chart countdown around sort of 78, 79, 80, it's a fucking crazy mix of kind of punk and, you know, the tail end of punk and post-punk and the early knockings of ska, and then you've got the tail end of disco and and there was just...
Everything was happening all at once.
And like,
all at once.
How was that, being like 14, 15 and just being surrounded by all these interesting and new romanticism brilliant. As well, obviously, was, you know, electronic music was starting to kick as well.
Yeah, and you realise that all that stuff happened in like a 5-year period.
Yeah.
And it's all the best music, you know?
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, there's so much good stuff now, but it's a very different thing because you also had the culture of it. You also had the kind of phenomenon of appointment TV, right? So Top of the Pops was the definitive thing that was happening to the youth, you know, because that's how young people define themselves and express themselves. You had your tribe. You got to move between tribes a bit because, you know, you could be a punk rocker and Scar came along and you went, oh, I'll have some of that.
Yeah.
You know, but it suited some people more and they got more into it. But then there were crossover stuff like the Jam, you know, and it's, oh my God, it was the best time to be a kid.
Yeah.
It was just amazing. And you had to contend with the rivalries, you know, there was the, I mean, at school, you had the punks and you had the soul boys.
Yeah.
You know, never the twain shall meet.
Yeah.
But you know what? I mean, in relatively recent years, I've rediscovered what they were all about. And I bloody love Haircut 100 now.
Yeah.
You know, and I bloody love Sade and all that stuff that was going on at the same time.
It's interesting.
Because it's still my youth. It was still playing. It was still there in the background, you know.
And you see these, you know, you hear these interviews with the likes of Don Letts and whatnot, and they're referencing, you know, the fact that reggae was filtering into the punk clubs. But then, you know, there's all these kind of, you know, it's documented that Lydon and the Clash were going to Lacey Lady in London and going to the Soul Nights as well. So, it must have been such a fantastic time to be in your kind of your formative years of learning and being exposed to all this kind of good or bad, like in tribalism, but just, you know, having so much going on. Because as I look at it now, but I probably have no place to be looking at as a 50-year-old man, I don't see as much tribalism in music now as what there was in then and throughout the 80s and probably most of the 90s as well, which, you know, I guess is a sad thing. But
I think that's down to the availability of everything all 100%, the time.
100%.
You know, whatever you want, you can go out and find it. So I don't think that kind of thing, I don't think it could exist now.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I mean, there are tribes. I mean, the K-pop thing is a really good example.
Metal's always got to be a tribe.
Metal always was and always will be a tribe. And I'm part of that tribe.
Yeah.
As well as being part of the punk tribe. More so now, I think, you know, I don't know. But then I don't define myself as a metaller.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I love the idea of extremity.
Yeah.
But when I have to listen to it for more than 20 minutes, I get tired, you know? Yeah. So for something to be metal and to appeal to me, it's got to be clever and melodic as well. So, I mean, my ideal band in that particular genre right now is Kvelertak from Norway. And I was trying to find a way of kind of wedging them into the questions you sent me.
Well done.
And I couldn't find one. No, I mean, there was one, and I'll mention it when it comes up. But then I was thinking, well, what song is there that I'm thinking of? And it was for this question, what's the best intro? And the answer is, it's a Kvelertak song, but I've been through all their albums a bit earlier, and I can't for the life remember which one it is.
Well, message me when you do, and we'll add it to the Spotify playlist.
The playlist.
I want to pick back up on Top of the Pops as well a little later, because, you know, the excitement of watching it in them formative years to then going on it. I want to know all about that later.
Yeah.
But right now, I'm going to ask you to tell me the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please, Ben.
Okay, for this, I've chosen the song that everybody nicks off me for every podcast I've ever been on, right? And this is which is 21st Century Schizoid Man by King Crimson. Okay. And the reason I've chosen it for the question about provoking an emotion is, number one, the sleeve of that album, which is of In the Court of the Crimson King, which is really scary when you're about 6 or 7 years old and you find it in your parents' record collection. But then you put the record on, you know, and I have plenty of opportunity to do that. And you've got this kind of wheezing kind of grim. It sounds almost like a dungeon, a torture dungeon, and kind of weird engines going in the background. And then all of a sudden it goes into this massive metal riff, proto-metal riff, which in turn goes into some mad kind of jazz exploration.
Yeah.
And then comes back and it's just a complete headfuck.
Mm.
And so that, I mean, it was shocking. I can't remember the first time I listened to it, but I listened to it a lot when I was very, very young, you know. So, I mean, you talk about provoking emotion and it's all in there. And I was reading and absorbing those lyrics, right, which are, it's horrific, you know. Cat's foot, iron claw, neurosurgeons scream for more, paranoia's poison door, 21st century schizoid man. And it just goes on in that vein. And it's like, and I knew that these were really awful, awful images that were being kind of generated in my head. I didn't understand them really, but I knew they were awful. You know, because the distorted vocal on it. And but also that was one of the first times that the distorted guitar became a really impressive sound to me. So it was provoking all sorts of stuff within me. And that, if I can point out, that was from my dad's side of the record collection. I don't know why he had it, you know. I mean, Dad wasn't really a big rock guy. He liked the blues, and he liked Eric Clapton, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, my dad was a jazz guy, really. He is, or at least I haven't heard him play in recent years, but he's an excellent jazz pianist. This is the kind of guy who'll go to Cuba and he'll get on the piano in the hotel with all the Cubano kind of musicians, and they will all go, "You're not bad." And South Africa, he's done that.
Yeah.
So you know what I mean? He's a bit of a show off from time to time, but he's very good. And my mum also is musical. She sings. And on my mum's side, I mean, this is where I'm going to cheat again, and I'm going to bring in another early recollection of something really grabbing me, and that was Steel I Span, Parcel of Rogues LP.
Okay.
And that's where my love of folk music comes from, and I do love folk music. I absolutely love it. But Steel I Span were a bit different because they were the new thing, which is electric folk, them and Pentangle and all that, all those people. And there's a song on Parcel of Rogues called Alison Gross, which I loved when I was 7 or 8 years old because it's about a witch. Okay, so this is a very relatable story. But it's also got this incredible kind of electric, distorted electric Telecaster guitar from, I think, Martin Carthy playing. And it is just mind-blowing when you're a kid.
Yeah.
So, but again, it's got the most distorted guitar I'd ever heard at that point. And it must be a real kind of proper old school fuzz pedal on it. So that was it. And again, this is so formative for me because it was that distorted guitar sound which led me down the path to where I was going to end up.
It's so important. It's so incredible that, you know, even at that age, you can recall and find yourself drawn to a glorious racket of, like, what's this? Like, this is, you know, this is abrasive. And yeah, and I tell you what, it's when you sent the list of songs over, Ben, I was going through them all again today, and when that King Crimson album popped up, even on Spotify, just a small little square on Spotify, that sleeve yet again just jolts you. It's such a powerful cover, and you know, you're so used to seeing it on, you know, every kind of magazine or book about the 100 greatest record covers ever made, and it still hits hard every time you look at that. It's such
shocks.
A stark, you know, piece of art. It's fantastic, and I get that you said that, you know, you. I'm sure, you know, why would you not pull that out of a record, you know, out of a stack of records and go, what's this going to sound like? Because that's going to pull you in.
And not only that, but it's a gatefold.
Yeah.
So you open that up and it just goes off into infinity on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, and it's weird. It's like pulsating pink.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And red flesh.
Yeah.
You know, from on the front, it's obvious, a screaming face, clearly in agony.
Yeah.
You know, and on the other side, it's this ear just going off into infinity. You know, and it's like, ooh, bloody hell. And then the album itself is such a massive variety because it goes from Schizoid Man into, I think, I can't remember what it's called, but it's really, it's a real quiet track and really kind of, it's not Moonchild, is it? Anyway. You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, it's kind of dragging you all down different paths, left, right, and center. And then it finishes with In the Court of the Crimson King, which just goes on and on and on and on. And it's in about five acts. And, you know, I mean, I found myself listening to a 2 or 3 hour podcast about that one album recently. Yeah. And found myself disagreeing violently with one of the protagonists on that about the drum sound on it. And then, you know, she was just saying, oh, that drum sound, it's so awful. And I was going, no, it isn't. It really isn't, because it's unique to that record.
Yeah.
And actually, I love it because that snare is just so kind of thin and high, but hard, you know, and it just pokes out of the mix. And anyway, I could go on about that for hours like they did. But I won't.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you to stay in the formative years for this track and tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school, please, Ben.
Yeah, right. Okay. I had to think long and hard about this one as well because, I mean, school time is at the school. Your school days is a long period of time, you know? So I went from being one thing to being something entirely different by the end of it. I mean, at the beginning of it, I was buying Womble's first LP.
Yeah. Right?
And by the end of it, I was buying Black Sabbath's entire back catalog. So, you know, I had to think quite carefully. But the one, the track for me that really crystallizes it is Tiger Feet by Mud.
Yeah.
And this is, for me, intimately associated with the end of week disco at a school trip to the Brecon Beacons when I was probably about 13, I suppose. So right on the cusp of adolescence, really awkward. I might even have been younger, you know, but Tiger Feet was still around. I'm guessing this would have been 75, 76. So actually, yeah, I must have been younger, 10 or 11. But there was a disco at the end. And Tiger Feet was the one song to which all the boys knew the dance, because we'd seen it on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
Where you stuck your fingers in your belt loops.
Yep.
And you did that. You know, and by that, for your listening only viewers, is where you stick your thumbs in your belt loops and you do the elbows out and forward and back. And
executed perfectly, by the way, Ben.
You go back. Thank you. I still remember it. It's muscle memory, you know. But that was the one where everybody knew the dance because we'd seen it on Top of the Pops a couple of weeks earlier. And and it was just, you know, it was like a meeting of minds. You know what I mean? I mean, and so for me, it just kind of, it's one of the tracks that kind of just epitomizes that glam era.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Mudd weren't particularly glam. Tyrus was, let's face it, you know, with the earrings and the curly hair and the kind of pantsuit. But at the same time, their shtick was a bit more kind of 50s throwback. So for me, that's just a signifier. But for me, glam was really important. You know, again, because I moved on from, like, my mum and dad's record collection to paying attention to Top of the Pops. And so it was, yeah, so it was Sweet for me was the band of that era, you know. So, I mean, this is the bit where I should be saying Ballroom Blitz.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, that wasn't the one that really kind of, that was me at home watching Top of the Pops. It wasn't really about school. But no, for me, Sweet were really it. Because do you know what? This kind of prefigured what came later, because Sweet were basically a hard rock band who were performing pop songs, but in that kind of format. And you know, you listen to that back catalogue now, and it's about as hard as anything got back then. You know, and I loved them to death.
Yeah, it's so strange when people talk glam, you know. I'm just a couple of years younger, and I miss that. And and for me, when people say glam, I instantly think Bowie, you know, T-Rex.
See, I didn't get Bowie, and I'm not a fan of T-Rex.
And what's strange is the band that gets spoken about the most on this podcast, without a shadow of a doubt, is The Sweet.
Yeah,
and for me, my knowledge was always just Ballroom Blitz and Phylum Next to Mudd as not quite a proper glam band like the others. But since, like, early on in this podcast, I think the first person, Alan McGee, was just telling me that it's one of his favourite bands. And I was like, oh, I'm going to go and listen to some more.
Yeah, I totally
Sweet.
Get that.
And then it's just come get that. Thick and fast. The amount of people that go, oh, it's all about The Sweet.
It really is. It really is. I mean, it's so weird. I went to see PJ Harvey at the Roundhouse.
Yeah.
A few weeks ago, and as after the gig had finished, you know, I don't know if you know about the Roundhouse, but it takes ages to get out.
I was
standing there, I was just talking to this female bouncer, and I said, so, you know, do you enjoy that? And she said, not really my thing, but I'm really looking forward to seeing The Sweet, you know, because they're playing here soon. And I went, oh, I tell you, and there's that connection. And she was probably in her late 40s, you know, maybe early 50s. Everybody loves The Sweet. Once you really get down to it, and you say to people, so where are you going to draw the line with glam?
Yeah.
You know, you'll either get the Bowie heads just going, Bowie, nothing else.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like Bowie. I got a little sampler flexi disc on one of my pop magazines back in the day. I mean, I used to regularly buy Pop Swap magazine, you know, which is aimed at girls, basically. But I wanted those posters, you know, I wanted those posters, I wanted the lyrics, because I was obsessed with pop music.
Was music a legit consideration for a career when you was at school?
No.
What did you want to do at school?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I think I probably wanted to be a bit of a Nepo baby and go into the BBC, not my dad. And I did to start with. You know, I'm not saying having a dad who was a bit of a high up at the BBC helped me get a job, but it probably did, you know. But, I mean, with that job, they offered me a promotion and I turned it down because I was about to go on tour. I said, I can't commit.
Yeah.
Honestly, I can't commit. I think something might be happening.
But that's where your loyalties clearly laid then, wasn't it? It was like, I know what I want to do.
No, but you know, my guitar playing at home wasn't a hobby. It was an obsession. I was doing it all the time.
Yeah.
You know, mum would come home and she and we lived in what's now a pretty posh bit of Chiswick in West London. And she would come in and she would say, I can hear you playing guitar from Turnham Green. Yeah, from the tube store. and that was a good 200 yards down the road.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I didn't kind of stint on the volume when I was playing because that's what excited me, you know.
Yeah. And tell me about like the sort of the kind of formation of Senseless Things and how you know how you sort of fitted into that and how that jigsaw started getting put together.
Well, I didn't have a lot to do with it, if I'm honest. I mean, you had Mark and Cass, who'd known each other forever from school, I think, and they were in bands from the age of about 11 or 12, because I think because they were both kind of misfits and, you know, didn't really get on with the discipline of schools. And I think they both had difficult kind of home lives as well. So they gravitated towards each other. Morgan was, I think, on the periphery of their friendship circle, and you know, I mean, they got together as like a trio with a couple of other kids, like before I came on the scene at all. I wasn't part of their circle. I was 4 or 5 years older than both than all of them. But I found them basically through my brother. My brother was in a band called the Milk Monitors. He knew Mark, and he was obviously 3 years younger than me. So he was in that kind of orbit and got to know Mark and Cass and Morgan by then, like through mutual friends kind of thing. And by that time, they had moved on and were around about the kind of crowd that was going to Richmond College. And basically, I think my brother heard on the grapevine that they were looking for another guitar player who could actually play. And of course, by dint of being a few years older than them, I could play by now.
Yeah. You know?
So I was I met them when they were about 15 or 16. Cass was 14, I think. And I was already, you know, 19 or 20. So I was really looking for an outlet.
Mm.
And that's how that started, you know. So, and it was practicing in musty cellars and, you know, kind of, but Mark was such a kind of wheeler dealer. He would go out and he knew that you had to go out and find stuff and make stuff happen. You know, so he would get his gigs and he would like just kind of organize it so that we got stuff done and stuff started to happen.
Every band needs someone to do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And he would write to people, you know, and once the band kind of started generating a bit of heat, then he would completely run our fan club and he would. Anyone who wrote to the address that we put on flyers, he'd write back to them, you know. Yeah. So he just engaged, engagement. He knew that from the very word go, that it's about engagement, and you kind of pull people into your orbit and keep them there and keep them interested and kind of let them know what's going on, send out little newsletters, whatever. And this is all, you know, these are all done on all done on kind of Xerox machines.
Yeah.
You know, and he'd use a college Xerox machine to run off a couple hundred flyers, you know, and he'd go out and he'd deliver them. He'd hang around about at gigs and hand them out to say, we're going to play somewhere. You know, so that's really, that's how we kind of start to generate the interest around the band. And we just played.
Yeah.
Snagged any gig we could.
Yeah.
You know, so.
We'll pick back up in a moment on that. But before we do that, if you can tell me the song that was the first track that you bought from a record store, please.
Yeah, do you know, I thought hard about this. And the quick answer is I can't remember, which is why I'm looking at my notes. Because I have to ask myself, was it though?
Yeah. You know?
And the honest answer is I don't know. The honest answer is I have not the foggiest idea. What was the first single I bought? It might well have been Ever Fallen in Love with Someone You Shouldn't Have by the Buzzcocks.
Yeah.
And I remember just that run of number one hits they had at around that time, just coming out of Another Music in a Different Kitchen into Love Bites, and it was just perfect. Do you know what I mean? And it was perfect. Buzzcocks got to number one with those songs, which are just the most brilliant, heartbreaking songs.
And they're pop songs as well. They're so infectious.
Exactly. This is really important to me. I mean, like I said, metal's great, but it's got to have the melody. It's got to have kind of a pop edge for me. Again, punk rock, it's fine, but I'm not a big fan of Discharge, for example, or GBH. Punk rock for punk rock's sake, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Really spiky hair, the leather bristle studs and acne, all that stuff. And like what I would call deliberately stupid punk. People mistaking punk for deliberately being thick and violent. You know, I didn't get that. What I did get was Pete Sherry being really arch. And when you look back on it, obviously gay, you know, and bringing that kind of sensibility into it. And you're right, just perfect pop, really simple, straight to the heart, no messing.
Yeah.
And talking about stuff that is really important to you as a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, really, you know, fucked up relationships. I mean, Senseless Things lifted wholesale from that. You know, one of our earlier gigs was supporting Steve Diggle's Flag of Convenience at the Sir George Robey, and that was the first review we ever got. Who was it? It might have been Kathy Unsworth who wrote that review. I think it probably was. And part of the reason for that, I think, is that we worship Steve Diggle as a former Buzzcock, you know, and that's how we might even have got that gig because Mark somehow swung it with Steve Diggle, you know, because we fucking loved the Buzzcocks. They were everything we wanted to be.
Yeah.
You know, write a punchy 3-minute pop or 2-minute song that tugs your heartstrings, but has buzzsaw guitars, but still has a melody.
Yeah.
That was the model, you know? So there you go. That's what we did.
So from playing like and let's call it the toilet circuit, you know, whether it be the George Robey and as you said, like, you know, Mark was booking you these gigs and you was playing as often as you can. And then I guess you then start to sort of appear on radars a little bit further outside of London, and people are starting getting wise and we're reading reviews about the Senseless Things. And then, you know, fast forward to, you know, the release of, I guess, Homophobic Arsehole and Easy to Smile and such. You find yourself on Top of the Pops. Like, Tell me.
Not with homophobia.
No, it was easy to smile, wasn't it, first? Yeah.
Like, yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And tell me about the day that you got that phone call saying you're going on Top of the Pops. And I'm going to load this question. And
now you're asking.
Did it deliver your expectations of going on Top of the Pops? And can you remember who else you was on there with? This is the first time. Obviously, I presume you was on there several times with Three Colours Red as well, yeah?
Twice, maybe. Okay. I think twice. But like most of my entire career with Sense Things, my memory is awful about that. I don't really remember who else was on with us, unless maybe... Was it Blue Pearl, Spice Girls?
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. Actually, I may be conflating because I have been on Top of the Pops a few times.
Yeah.
You know, but as I said, my memory is absolutely abysmal. I so wish I'd get to diary now. Yeah. You know? But I can remember the experience was probably exactly what you would expect it to be. It's actually very well choreographed by a really brilliant floor team who know exactly what they're doing. And you just fit into the machine that is Top of the Pops. You know, there is no room for fucking about or being an asshole.
Yeah.
I mean, it's made very clear to you that everyone is expected to be a bit professional about it. You know, even for a bunch of scamps like us who were usually up for being a little bit iconoclastic kind of thing. No. This is the all hallowed Top of the Pops. But it says something about it. I think that my main memory from the first time we did it was hanging out with the EastEnders cast in the bar afterwards. Because, of course, it was recorded at Elstree.
Then. Yeah.
And the next stage along was EastEnders. I mean, you know, Albert Square was just around the back of the building.
Fantastic.
It was fantastic. And, you know, there's Barbara Windsor catching a fag off me.
Wow.
You know, and she was lovely. She was really, really, really lovely. I mean, she was clear. Used to meeting all the bands who were kind of coming out.
Yeah.
Top of the Pops looking a bit shell-shocked.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, fantastic.
That is great. I mean, I love that. That was brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, I also love the experience of getting a car sent for you to take you up there and bring you back. But actually, you know, when I think about it, I mean, I look at it now and I kind of go, oh, yeah, I kind of remember what was going on.
Yeah.
And we were all pros. You know, by that point,
yeah.
You know, we'd learned the craft and we knew what we were doing. So... It wasn't that hard to nail it.
Yeah.
I think at that point you had to sing live, or Mark had to sing live, but the rest of us were miming.
Yeah.
So it was just a case of putting on the best show you could.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. So I guess there was some going out there. I mean, I've seen you give me a little kind of heads up on this, and this is the question where I ask you about the song soundtrack Your Year's Clubbing, and you've kind of chose the same answer as another 500 guests of this podcast that are all musicians.
Of course,
so you're in very, very good company.
But I bet my context is slightly different.
It is.
Okay, I mean, I never went clubbing. You know, the late 80s, early 90s, clubbing completely passed me by.
Yeah.
I've never even done ecstasy.
Yeah.
You know, I must be almost unique for people of my generation because, yeah. Well, maybe I had it once and it was great. But you know what? It certainly wasn't a lifestyle for me. And I didn't go clubbing. I was doing rock gigs for a living at the time, you know. So that's where I spent all of my time. The clubs I went to were the ones in the kind of darker recesses of the West End, like Alice in Wonderland and mostly Syndrome.
Yeah.
So where I got to hang out with the other kind of indie cognoscenti. So that's what I was doing. I was not going to clubs and losing my tits to kind of rave. I just wasn't. So I don't have a kind of, you know, I don't have a kind of rave track to chuck into the mix. But as you said, I do have. So I thought, well, what was my nearest equivalent to that? And this kind of goes back to another of my teen hobbies, which was skateboarding. So not many people know this, but you remember the kids' TV show on ITV, their competitor to Blue Peter called Magpie, right? Magpie came to my school to investigate the new craze of skateboarding in 1976. So he had Mick, whatever his name was, with the big hair.
That's right.
Kind of trying skateboarding. And I was one of the kids tooling around on Magpie with my really shit, too short kind of brown corduroy flares and a really horrible kind of lime yellow helmet, you know, and my V-neck jumper with kind of elbows missing. But kind of demonstrating on my really terrible skateboard, this kind of new art of skateboarding. But I got better as a skateboarder a bit later in life. And I used to go down to a place called Rolling Thunder in Brentford. I get on, you know, get in the tube, go down to Kew Bridge and then down the road to Rolling Thunder, where you pay your quid. And it was a fabulous indoor skate park. So you had all the bowls and all that stuff. And there's a real kind of culture around it. So I was reading the American magazines that they import and sold in the newsagent underneath the pawn. And one of the important things about it was they had a big sound system in there and they would play what was current in that scene. And what was current in that scene, and this is 77, so it was Star Wars, but it was also Donna Summer, wow. I Feel Love. And that just went on forever, and it was hypnotic, and it was Giorgio Moroder, and it was and it suited skateboarding down to the ground because you're just concentrating. So I loved it, you know, and that was my introduction to electronic music. That was my introduction to disco, you know. Starship Trooper was another. I fell in love with the Starship Trooper.
Yeah. That was Andrew. Was that Andrew Lloyd Webber? Was it Sarah Brightman that sang it?
Yes, it probably was.
Yeah.
Now you mention it. Yeah. Yes, it probably was. It was just an attempt to kind of get on the back of Star Wars craze and all that, and combine that with disco, which obviously it was massive at the time. But that Donna Summer track, I mean, I can't remember what the remix of it is.
Oh, it's the Patrick...
Yes, that one.
Oh my god! Do you know what?
It's like it's the same one, but it's just even better.
Oh, how can you make that record better? Yet somehow he did. Like it's fucking ridiculous. I'd never heard that, and I had Mark Moore from S Express on very, very early on in this podcast, and he chose it, and
that
he
was like,
and he was, "Have you heard this one?" And I was like,
"Yeah,
no." And it's like, I think that is the greatest piece of electronic music ever, ever.
Yeah,
and
how do you improve on Giorgio Moroder?
I mean,
seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's as close to perfect. I do like a little bit of Supernature by Cerrone, but it's a poor man's I Feel Love. But,
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to Quince.com/style for free shipping
and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Kind of come to all of this stuff late. I'm glad I found it now. I mean, that along with like Northern Soul,
yeah,
blah, 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 you know.
Perfect, perfect. It's really weird that you say that you didn't go clubbing and skateboarding was a big thing. And the amount of people that have referenced skateboarding as well as introducing them to music, but different eras, you know.
Yeah. I mean, they're almost 10 years apart,
you
know, or slightly more than 10 years apart. It's just, I never kind of got clubbing as a thing.
Mm.
I always found it weirdly kind of slightly intimidating, although obviously it was the opposite of that.
Yeah.
I had a lot of friends who were really into it. Indeed, Mark really enjoyed going clubbing, but it just really wasn't my thing. I was more of a goth at the time. Yeah. You know, it's like the goth bit in me was a bit of a hangover from the late 80s.
Yeah.
And yeah, I suppose ecstasy wasn't my drug, really, you know. So, yeah, I think I just didn't really get it.
Yeah. Was you going to the kind of rock clubs, like, in the sort of early 90s, like the, what was the one at Camden Palace? I can't remember what that was called, but there was lots of...
Again, not really. I mean, you know, I wasn't really exploring my heavy metal side at this point either.
Mm.
Fact is, I was playing gigs most of the time.
Sure.
Bear in mind that from 89 to 92, Sensor Things were playing around 200 plus gigs a year.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
You know, sometimes more in one or two of those years. We were playing almost 300 gigs a year. So frankly, when I wasn't playing gigs, I didn't want to go and see gigs.
Yeah.
I didn't even want to listen to any fucking music.
Yeah.
I just wanted to sit at home or watch a bloody telly. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I did.
Okay.
So, yeah, no, I mean, and my social life revolved completely around my job. So, you know, if I went to a club, it'd be after a gig.
Yeah.
Because I needed to wind down and I needed to have a drink with some friends. And that's exactly what I did.
And they would have been... Other sort of bands and your crew and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe not even the crew, you know, but and maybe not even with my band, you know. But if I was going to go out, it would be to something like that, you know.
Yeah.
Usually where other bands would be hanging out, because it'd be more people in bands and less people who are fans of bands.
Yeah, sure.
So you didn't have to kind of. Maintain that person you are, which isn't quite you, like post-gig, pre and post-gig.
Yeah, understand.
You know, and you can just hang around with people who kind of got it.
Yeah. You know? Okay. For track six, favourite song from an artist from your home county, please, Ben.
Now, this was really hard as well, because there's not much choice from Staffordshire. You talk about my home county, right? My home county is really London, because that's where I've grown up from the age of 11. But I was not born in London. I was born in Stoke-on-Trent. So, you know, I could have gone the Guns N' Roses route here, because Slash was born exactly to the day, 1 year, I think, before me in the Royal Victoria Hospital, Stoke-on-Trent. So same place, exactly 1 year before, 64. But you know what? I don't like Guns N' Roses enough to give them a nod in this particular rundown. And through researching for this question, I discovered that actually one of my all-time favourite artists comes from Staffordshire, from Burton-upon-Trent, ladies and gentlemen. I give you Joe Jackson, Now, there's another couple of add-ons to this, because... With Joe Jackson, I find it really hard to choose between his eras. There were the first two LPs, which was his I Know, I Can Find a Way In or the Coattails of Punk,
yep.
right? So you've got Look Sharp and you've got I'm the Man. And those, I absolutely love those records, right? Indeed, in one of my more recent bands, The Faction, we covered I'm the Man by Joe Jackson. And it's a cracking number. And there's a bit of a crossover with the old metal streak that I've been demonstrating here because, of course, there's a track called off the same album called Got the Time. And Anthrax covered that, you know, didn't announce it as a Joe Jackson cover, but that is that's Anthrax covering Joe Jackson.
Fantastic.
And it is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
However, it's neither of those songs that I've chosen. What I've chosen is the one where I never bought this record. It's off Night and Day. My dad bought it because all the dads were buying it. Okay, and it's because that's his soft jazz crossover LP with a bit of hyper-modern production. And that was what really sold it to people was the production, and it was a deliberately luxurious product. It was on 180-gram vinyl, and it was heavy as fuck. The sleeve was utterly beautiful, very kind of cool, jazzy kind of representation. I think line drawing of a piano on the front, you know, very hip kind of bit of production. And the production itself was hyper 80s, clean, perfect. It sounded amazing. And the track I've chosen off it is the obvious one, actually, which I forgot what it's called because I'm ranting so much about the,
It was his first number one as well, I believe.
It was yeah. Stepping Up.
Yeah.
Of course it's Stepping Up, of course. And then, you know, you go back and listen to it in the context of thinking about it. And again, it's got that, it's. I think that's obviously sequenced when you listen to it now. It's either that or they are the most stunning session musicians.
Yeah.
But I'm certain that he was probably getting into a bit of sequencing at this point.
Yeah.
And just thinking about all of this was, I've loved Joe Jackson since the late 70s. Almost everything he's done. You know, he's a truly special artist, I think. And you go back and you do a little bit of a retrospective and you think, well, I was a bit naive back there, so I wasn't really listening to the lyrics. And particularly on that album, there is some stuff which is heartbreaking and which is basically him coming out through music as well. You know, that you know, Real Men is a fucking amazing, mind-blowing song. And I listened to the whole album again recently while I was doing the housework, you know, doing the hoovering, you know, and I ended up almost in tears by the end of side two because it is really emotional, and I hadn't really clocked that kind of 40 years ago now.
Yeah,
is it 40 years, 30 years? Anyway,
yeah, it's 40 years
but
ago.
Yeah, last 40 years year. Ago. Yeah, and. Yeah, I hadn't really clocked it then, but I do now.
Yeah.
I'm a bit more emotionally intelligent now than I was then. You know?
Yeah.
But, oh, my God, what a song. Yes, Stepping Out.
It's pretty close to perfect.
It's
like me and my best mate, one of my earliest memories of him, and we talk about it to this day, is recording Top of the Pops and us going around there and sitting there and watching Joe Jackson doing Stepping Out on there, because it sat with what was going on in electronic music as well. That kind of playover was, you know, I wouldn't throw it as synth pop, but, you know, it'd sit on them kind of early sort of 80s pop albums, yet you'd see Joe Jackson on like these kind of new wave and post-punk albums as well. He just made fucking great records.
He really did. And, you know, you listen to those two early records.
Yeah.
Again, the production's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, and It's really hard to play like the guys that you play on his album. It's sounds deceptively simple.
Yeah.
You know, it's not.
I can imagine.
And I love it. Yeah. So listen to that Anthrax cover.
Oh, I will.
They do it justice.
I'm going to find it and I'm going to add it to the Spotify playlist for this part as
pop
well.
Pop that on the playlist. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this is your last track, Ben, and I'm going to ask you for a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear.
Okay, right. I'm going to give you the two best 7-inch singles ever made, right? And you can tell me, because I know I've given you a bit of a heads up on these two, you can tell me if you'd ever heard of them before, before this. So first is My Pal by the Aussie band God. They were about 14 or 15 when they released this. And it's just a brilliant little scream of teenage angst. Again, it's a perfect pop song. The refrain is, "You're my only friend. You don't even like me," right? Which I think we can all identify with. And it's got the if you'd have asked me what was the best guitar solo of all time, I'd have said that is the best guitar solo of all time. It's one note, feeding back, screaming for about a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. So I love that. However, neck and neck with that little 7-inch. Oh, by the way, the cover of that was also absolutely perfect. It was just God in degraded capital letters on a red sleeve, in black, on a red sleeve.
Yeah.
And that was it. You know, absolutely perfect little product. And up there with that, neck and neck, is a track called I Don't Need the Reasons by a band called The Eastern Duck, also Australian, who I was, can't even remember who introduced me to them. But I'm now mates with the former bass player on Facebook. And Bill is a fabulous guy. He ended up supporting the Descendants just last week in Australia with a kind of revival of one of the bands that he'd been in. Because if you know, you know. Okay. The Eastern Dark were just, I think, on the verge of something great when they had an awful accident on the way back from a gig. The van flipped and the singer and guitarist was killed. So that's the kind of thing that just stops something like that dead. But in the run-up to that, they'd done an album and a couple of singles, and it's just the most perfect punk pop. It's crystallized. It really crystallizes that thing, whatever it is. But you know what? You listen to that and you slot it in your mind alongside Senseless Things and Mega City 4. You can just hear it, you know, but they preceded us by a few years, you know. But yeah, the Eastern Duck, man, seriously, I would urge anyone to go out and find it. They're on Spotify and you will put them on the playlist. But but for me, I Don't Need the Reasons is one of those absolutely perfect songs. It's got everything in it. It's got a key change. It's got a breakdown. You know, it's got the harmonies. Just perfect. Yeah, I worship it. I worship Bill Gibson for being in them, you know.
I've never heard either of them until I got your list over, and I've been listening to them today. And I can hear the Senseless Things in it. 100%.
Absolutely. Yep.
And we put together the Spotify playlist, and I was listening through it today, and just once you finish listening to this episode, go and check that playlist out, because there's some fantastic records on there. And obviously we put a lot of your music on there as well, Ben. What's happening with your music now? Where are you at?
I'm now 58, so I play. You know, I rehearse with my friends in my current band called the Charlemagnes. I have too many guitars, And so I amused myself by kind of swapping them around and trading stuff with other people. And weirdly, I mean, I've always been a Gibson guy, all the kind of double humbucker kind of bloke. But I've kind of recently had this little bit of a thing for jazz masters, you know. So started out, I've got myself a Squire J. Mascus jazz master,
nice.
Which completely flipped my thing, I don't like Fender stuff, on its head. And now I've gone, okay, fine. I now like jazz masters. So now I've gone and swapped a Gibson Explorer, you know, metal, proper metal guitar, for a jazz master, a proper expensive one, like nearly 2,000 quid's worth of jazz master. And once I have that repaired, that'll be great. But no, this is it, and it's almost like that's the new me. But anyway, I play in a band called the Charlemagnes. We are a fictional kind of proto-punk band from somewhere in New Jersey in 1966, 67. That was the idea, but yeah. It's kind of grown into something a bit different. And I think we're about to go and record a double LP.
Fantastic.
Because we've worked up to a double LP's worth of songs over lockdown. Oh, we've already got one LP out. You can look us up on Bandcamp. So, you know, the first album's on there. That's rough and ready, but it's pretty good, if I do say so myself.
Well, we'll add the Bandcamp link to the show notes as well, so people can go and explore that as well.
Okay.
Ben, it's been an absolute delight talking records with you, mate. Thank you so much for giving up your time, mate.
I love this shit, mate. I could talk for hours about this stuff. Yeah. It's been come up with a different set of questions. We'll come out
doing. Oh well, we do that, Ben. We do that, and we sometimes change it up, and we ask all the questions about gigs and touring. And the songs that you recall from that. So
well, that'd be useless for me, mate.
Oh, you can't remember shit anyway, can you?
I mean, how did you feel about seeing Metallica night after night after fucking night for like 5 years? Oh, Jesus Christ! If I never hear Metallica again, it'll be too soon. And don't even get me started on fucking Marilyn Manson. Anyway.
Ben, I'm going to press stop, but don't go anywhere.
Yep. Cheers.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, Ben Harding, that was so much fun. And as I said at the beginning, we carried on having a good old natter afterwards. What a top man. Can't thank Ben enough for giving up his time and coming on and chatting on the pod. Thanks to you lot for giving up your time to have a good old listen. I hope you had if you had a fraction of the joy that I had having that chat, then you've had a good time. As mentioned, why not go check out the back catalogue? There's stacks and stacks of episodes all to be enjoyed. Go and have a little look through. There's loads of episodes. I'm sure you're going to be like, oh, I wonder what he chose for that, for that question. Go and have a good old look. And everything you need to know about the podcast is on the one-stop shop, which is offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Click the show notes for all the links if you can't remember that. And I will see you next time. Bye-bye.